The plan now is that we're going to have six of the people whose posters are behind there, I believe it's six, come forward and give very short presentations. So we'll get them to do that in turn. And then after that, we'll use what time remains till 5:15 to discuss various topics, which ones we can discuss before we discuss them. Okay, so are we going to... I've got six names on my piece of paper here. The winner is Daniel Brito from Toulouse.
Okay, I'm Daniel Brito. I work indeed in Toulouse and Tarbes. The subject of my poster is granulation and supergranulation. The physical origin of supergranulation is still unclear, and what I show in this poster is new observations trying to make the things better, make things clearer. I have three kind of measurements. The first measurements are direct imaging from the Observatoire of Pic du Midi, showing velocity fields and showing nice peak, nice spectrum, showing at which scale the supergranulation peaks. This is obtained from very high, large field, large resolution field of measurements. The second kind of measurements we want to obtain is from is using magneto-optical filters, which is a small cell containing potassium gas. And through an inverse Zeeman effect, we should be able to retrieve the component of the velocity fields along the line of sight and the component of the magnetic field along the line of sight. So we are at present calibrating these cells in the lab, and we are hopefully we will be able to put this cell soon at the peak du midi to observe the sun. And the last kind of measurements is obtained from the satellite INODE, which gives very nice pictures of the velocity field and magnetic fields. So, and that's it. So I'm discussing on that poster these different kind of measurements.
Okay, the second lucky winner. Yeah. The second lucky winner is Irina Kityashvili from
Goal of our investigation it is a representation of main properties of solar cycles investigation possibility prediction of the sunspot number variations. For this, we investigate nonlinear dynamical dynamo model, which include Parker's dynamo equations and equation for turbulent magnetic helicity. For connection between sunspot number and magnetic field, we use the Bressel suggestion about connection between the sunspot number variation and toroidal magnetic field in the form of Rihel's law. We obtained periodical and chaotic solutions for the convective zone parameters, which represent main properties of sunspot number variation, variations like fast growth of sunspot number and slowly decay. Also, we obtained a very good relationship between amplitude and growth time and decay time, like we observed for sunspot number variations. Unfortunately, we always have a problem what our models include some uncertainties, and observational data also include unknown errors. For solution of these problems, we used data simulation methods, which helped us take into account some errors of models and observational data. On this plot, you can see results of implementation Ensemble-Kalman filter, which very powerful in case nonlinear systems. Gray line shown exact solution of our model, and brown line shown solution after correction by Ensemble-Kalman filter. And in final, I would like to present a prediction for the next solar cycle 24. The same procedure we tested for several previous solar cycles, and have good agreement. Thank you.
Okay, next we have Nick Nelson. You want to go with, okay. So you want to go in different order?
Well, just because this one's on here as well.
Okay, all right. So we'll have Roman Cherbikov in that case from the Center for Astrophysics, Harvard.
Pointer. Okay. All right, so my poster is on some self-consistent modeling of accretion, yet spherically symmetric, in the realistic setup when I have some MHD turbulence. So I'm trying to build some algebraic model of turbulence that, first of all, based on some numerical simulations of isotropic homogeneous turbulence. So I find numerical coefficients from there. So I have random velocity field, random alpha, speed, basically random magnetic field, and eventually includes all the effects that are normally modeled, like small-scale dynamo action, dissipation of magnetic and kinetic energies, then return to isotropy effects, return to magnetic-kinetic equipartition, and even the selective decay. Then I have some system of equations for basically the inflow of matter and try to calculate the accretion rate. And I have some anisotropic turbulence. So these are the results of my calculations. One of the results is that there is some magnetization as a function of radius. So everything depends on the radius, averaged over angles. And magnetization grows from some 0.1 to 3 as matter falls into the black hole. That is consistent with the actual numerical simulations. Plus, I can make such a plot of velocities. We see that alpha speed is about sound speed. And there is some sonic point and some standard variation and even force-free states near the black hole. So my poster also describes some future work. And I'm going to calculate some realistic equation setup with some model for with some mean fields model, and most probably that will be a two-scale direct interaction approximation that has many advantages. In particular, it allows to calculate self-consistent coefficients on some small-scale fields, plus it has evaluation of large-scale fields. So we'll see how it's going to work. And I'd like to solicit feedback from all people who do theory. Thanks.
We have Nick Nelson.
All right, I'm Nick Nelson. I'm part of what Yuri termed the ash mob. And so I won't go into detail about that, but my poster is particularly looking at a particular case of a rapidly rotating sun-like star that exhibits some odd behavior. It goes through oscillations in magnetic field strength and actually reverses magnetic polarity. So these three are Moiety projections. This is the radial velocity patterns that we get near the top of the convection zone, where we have these nice banana cells up at the top, and then more granular convection at the poles. If we go to the mid-convection zone and look at the toroidal magnetic field, we flip from a state where we have different we have negative polarity in the northern hemisphere, positive in the southern. It goes through a flip in magnetic polarity and establishes bands of magnetic field in the middle of the convection zone, but with opposite senses. And this is a time history of some of the the energy densities. And the relevant ones that I want you to look at right now are these orange and red, which are the toroidal and poloidal magnetic energy densities. They go through kind of normal oscillations, and then they go through this large flip, and they come out the other side with opposite polarity. This is interesting for a number of reasons, but particularly it's interesting because we can look at some of the reasons why this particular dynamo simulation did flip fields, which hopefully gives us clues to other dynamo reversals that we can see in the sun and other stars. So thank you very much.
Okay. Now, you want to get into this?
Yeah.
Oh.
You can read it. Okay, hi, I'm Katie Richardson. I'm a first year PhD student at Cambridge. More trouble than it's worth, hey? So yeah, I'm working with Mike Proctor at Cambridge, and I've been studying the effects of fluctuations on alpha omega dynamo models. Sorry. Okay, so in this work, we look at a one-dimensional dynamo wave model, and we let alpha vary rapidly in space and time. Now, this work was done last year by Proctor, and there was just time dependence, and now we've been looking at space dependence as well. We get a new term in our equations that depends just on the fluctuations of alpha. And We solve these equations and we get a dispersion relation which relates our dynamo number D, which depends on the mean alpha, and this term Q, which is our dimensionless term for the fluctuations of alpha. And in this graph here, you can see we plot D squared against Q, and the lines are fixed M. And we can get dynamo action for when D squared is zero, so when there's no mean alpha. But having the space dependence now in these equations means we can make Q negative, and we can extend this graph into the negative region. And so we get dynamo action for negative Q, but a higher critical value of D squared, so the dynamo is harder to excite. And we also solve these equations numerically and to investigate cyclical behavior and the stability of the solutions. Thank you.
Thanks. And last of all, our own Silver, support open from Cambridge.
Hi. Hi, well, I'm Lara Silvers. I'm currently at the University of Cambridge, but the work that I'm presenting here is actually work I did while at the Ecole Normale Supérieure in Paris, working alongside Steve Balbus. My background was in solar physics, so I had to come to the literature on the MRI completely afresh. And as I was actually reading the literature, I noticed that in many of the early calculations, the average of the Shakura and Sunyaev alpha was taken over a very few number of orbits, largely due to the computational constraints of the time. So what we wanted to do was, with the new computational resources, extend alpha, and rather than just take an average over a fixed number of orbits, calculate a long-term running average. And so what I'm presenting here is work where alpha is averaged via a running average over 1,000 orbits, and we examine the effect of varying the box size as well as the dissipation scale. And I also discussed some of the problems that you get while doing these shearing box calculations over large numbers of orbits.
Okay. We should probably get rid of Steve's computer. Yeah, well, it's not. So now we've got 15 minutes, I guess, just to talk about this, that, and the other. So what we did, I got together with Steve and Chris, and we made a list of things that might be interesting to discuss. And because we've only got 15 minutes, it's not a very long list. So I assume I can rub this off now. So the list consists of the following. So everything really is connected with what we talked about today. So one issue is the location of the dynamo. Second is an issue which has been sort of reared its head but not really been addressed much here, which is whether you really need fields of 100 kilogauss, which I think is a problematic thing for many of the dynamos that we know and love to actually cope with. Another issue which again came up this morning but wasn't discussed very much is the thickness of the tachocline. And the final thing, which I'll put down the bottom because it's me pushing my own barrow, is the regularity of the solar cycle. So I think probably what we should do is have a straw poll as to which one of those would be the most interesting ones to one to start with. What do people feel about location? How many people? Or we c- Two hands from Yuri. Well, okay, we'll start with a location then. So, no, I suppose really we should. How about the 100 kilogas field? Well, a couple.
Go with a location. Come on. Organized. Who wants to talk about the location? I saw some hands going up. Yeah. Go on, Axel. Yeah. You want to
go. So one critical point here is whether or not we can make sunspots in situ, so to speak. That is, a sunspot that is not really rooted at the base of the convection zone, but it's forming out of the turbulent magnetic field that we have within the convection zone, and it's just able to concentrate near the surface. So that is, I think, primarily then a question to the observers, whether they find any evidence, or could even think of any evidence, by which we can support the picture of some narrow tube moving all the way from the bottom to the top. So what is the support from the observational side?
Have a go at that one.
Can I repeat your question, Axel? I'm not sure I understood what.
Question is whether we can make sunspots in situ without relying them from coming all the way from the bottom up to the top, but just producing a local concentration of something much more diffuse at the minute when they come through the surface.
Okay, yeah, I can comment on this because we've been looking for formation of sunspots with heliosismology, and it's been a controversial topic because what we see is that we see sunspots growing from the top. And when we show these, people say, oh, you measure something incorrectly, because, you know, it's impossible. You know, sunspots appear, they emerge from the bottom of the convection zone, and you see sunspot growing actually from the top down. So people laugh on this. But, you know, the more we look at this, you know, we more have evidence for this. So that's what's observational. So that we're trying to improve techniques as best we can. And what is needed now in heliosismology, actually, what we do, we use some simple models of wave propagation to measure this. So what we need to test this by using numerical simulations. So putting now a lot of effort in doing some realistic numerical simulations like Bobstein, he's running now in Colombia. It's a big box, 96 by 96 megameters is magnetic field. So we can test actually these predictions, but it's quite possible that at sunspots, the concentration happens near the surface.
It would have been great to see the Hinode movie, and when you look at these movies, it's kind of interesting to see that actually the field seems to be getting out first radially, and then as the structure evolves and the sunspot form, you have what they call the yin-yang effect, and you got also what they call sea serpent. And so these structures that are actually emerging is that the field is quite radial at the beginning with what they call sea serpents, stripes of different polarity, which black and white if you are in a magnetogram. And then after a little while, the structure extends slightly, like if it was an arch getting out, and the structure rotates a bit, and you have what they call the yin-yang effect. So like the symbol yin. Yang. So this I found hard to explain as a local concentration. So it looks really like a structure emerging. And the reason why you got this sea serpent effect is because some of the field lines are being pinned down by some mass that will have been put in a twist of the field lines where the mass is there, and it's why you get this sea serpent. So I mean, some observational evidence, we have to agree on the observational evidence, but seems to indicate that the sea serpent is really a signature of emerging structures and not local concentration.
No, Sasha, it's two different issues here. The first, you know, we discuss formation of sunspots. It's different from what you describe as emerging flux. And formation of sunspots happens later, after flux appeared. You need some to have some concentration first. So first, magnetic flux appears without sunspots. But Axel's question was about sunspots, right? So that's what I agree with you, that this is...
Yuri. Yuri wants to go. My ebullient Italian friend Fausto says that that's him. He had a red hat on earlier. That the more we know, the less we know, or we're in trouble. Maybe Fausto would tell us, where do you think the dynamo is? Is it everywhere? Is it nowhere? Here's a microphone. You can't
escape. I think you have to come to the conclusion that the dynamo is everywhere. I mean, you have to be sort of generating field everywhere, but that's not really what you want. You want to understand where, what organizes the magnetic field into what we call the activity cycle. I mean, if you just have a mass of small-scale turbulence, I mean, that doesn't help anyone. And to say, where it is, it may be everywhere, but, maybe a more sensible question is to say, suppose that we did have a working model of the solar dynamo that did the honorable thing, which we don't have, which is kind of annoying, but if we did, a good question would be operationally, what could it be that you can remove and still retain, a working cycle until you get to the point that you remove something and it goes away? So you say, like, what is the minimal set of things that you need for this thing to organize the field into a recognizable magnetic cycle? And I certainly don't know. I don't know if anyone has a clue. In terms of magnetic field generation, I think you're generating field everywhere. Where you're generating a lot of flux is not totally clear at all. But one way to word it is to say, okay, suppose that we did have a model and we switched things off, what would happen? What would we do with this?
So I just want to make maybe the obvious point that the organization of the field in the photosphere may or may not be that well related to the properties of the dynamo. And what I mean by that is the photosphere, the radiative boundary layer of the sun is an extremely, it's a place dominated by differential radiative losses driving dynamics. So every time you have a magnetic element in the photosphere, depending on its size and the magnetic flux density, you have variations in the opacity of the gas, which drive flows locally on the scale of the magnetic flux element. And so when we think about things like sunspots and network and plage regions on the sun, each of those drives radiative losses and obstructs convective dynamics differently. And those radiative losses are critical in how those structures organize themselves in the photospheric layers. So when we look at the photosphere for signatures of the dynamo, we have to be careful that we also understand that there are very strong dynamical effects in the photosphere itself due to the differential radiative losses through the magnetic structures.
I think there's a tendency for observers to try and put things where they can see them, because they like to observe these things, and then they think, well, these things must be happening somewhere near where we can observe them. And Cowling had something to say about this. He thought most of what you can see at the surface were what he called epiphenomena. It's very hard to see how a dynamo can be driven at the surface of a star or near the surface. And so, I mean, not a dynamo, a large-scale activity cycle. And for years, people were trying to put it there because that's what they could see. And then there was the Tachycline discovered, and everybody tried to put things there. And now people are trying to put things kind of in both places, right, and link them by a meridional flow. But just because we observe something, it doesn't mean necessarily that is the key feature. I mean, we have this turbulent convecting gas there. It's kind of wrong to ignore the theory of turbulent convection and differential rotation and just rely on observations. So you can be misled by observations.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say that with respect to connecting the Tachocline to the surface, one thing that, if my estimate is correct, if you take the strong fields in the Tachocline and ask them to leave, basically decay every solar cycle, the amount of luminosity you would get if all that were converted into heat is well above the X-ray luminosity in the corona. And I wonder if that's correct for those of you that may have made that estimate from the simulations, and if that's a helpful thing to think about. In other words, a small fraction of that energy is getting up to the corona, and that may be also the cup is half full for Nick, because I mean, if you're only getting, I mean, just that's just something to throw out there. It seems to me that flux is the energy has to be either dissipated or a small fraction getting to the corona.
And I can address that a little bit, but maybe we should ask Matthias. But I think you only run into problems when you introduce field strengths that you of something like 10 kilogauss or something at the base of the convection zone. If you just take the flux in SARS at face value and convert that into a magnetic field strength, it's a small fraction of the luminosity of a star. It's only when you amplify it and put it at the base of the convection zone. Yeah, I don't know that offhand. Maybe somebody else does.
Yeah, I think one of these one of the issues here is to make the difference between different theories, either distributed dynamos or Tachocline dynamos. And one good way of making a difference between the two or three types or four types of dynamo that we have would be to rule them out one after the other. And regarding the dynamo based on which has the Tachocline as an important element and the rise of buoyant flux tubes, for instance, I'd like to ask the competent authorities here if there is some hint that the turbulent dynamics within the bulk of the convection zone actually has the ability just to prevent the flux tubes from rising to the surface. Because most of the simulation seems to be fairly diffusive, and it's not clear that the dynamical effects are taken into account properly. So,
yeah, we've done some work on these type of things, and myself with a student, Kelly Klein, did some rising tubes through convection, and there's also some work by Fan, Fisher, and Abbott. Those guys at the same time did the same sort of thing. And the thing you find is that for a concentration, an idealized flux tube, to rise through a convection zone, you need the energy in the magnetic field to be at least in equipartition with the strongest things that it's going to encounter on the way, and maybe a little bit stronger. So you get this bizarre situation whereby you've got to create this magnetic flux tube which is strong compared to the convection, which is probably the thing which generates all the processes which generated the flux tube. So you have this sort of circular paradox in this thing, which is a bit of a problem in my mind. It's one of the things that I'm worried about. But one of the little caveats, or you can get away with something, is that most of the work that's been done has always been done in the context of these simple idealized flux tubes, which is like a hose. So it has an encasing sheath. And then, as we all know, if you want to take a flux tube, even of a very small size, and bring it to the surface of the sun in that context, then this thing's going to expand, you know, by the factor of the density scale heights, which is about 1,000. So a small tube will cover the surface of the sun, and usually the way people argue around that is that you have mass flux down the hose away from the rising part of it, and that allows it not to have to expand so much. But I think, you know, some of those things can be circumvented by not dealing with these idealized flux tubes. So we've worked a little bit, you know, Fasten, Steve, myself, on these You know, you find in full calculations, you find flux concentrations, which have field lines going in and out of these things. They're not encased in flux surfaces. And so the dynamics of those objects is entirely possibly completely different from the dynamics of thin flux tubes and these, you know, idealized flux tubes. So I think that's one of the big gaps with the tachocline dynamo model, is that, you know, we don't really know how you get something from the tachocline to the surface safely, and maybe you need to do something weird at the surface to sort of recombine things so that it looks like a magnetic active region like that. But there's a big gap that we don't understand, and that's the main argument about, well, it's one of the biggest pieces missing, I think, from the dynamo in the, or the organization in the tachocline model that we have. But I think we might be able to learn something from studying the dynamics of magnetic concentrations rather than these older concepts of flux tubes.